Hey everyone, welcome to the New Insight Podcast, where we interview the most important movers and shakers in ophthalmology and give you new insights on the innovations ahead. I'm your host, Viral Shuth. My guest today is Dr. David Eichenbaum. If you've been fortunate enough to run into David, you know he's one of the biggest personalities in retina. He's the Director of Research for Retina Vitreous Associates of Florida and runs one of the busiest clinical trial centers in the country. If you're at any of the major meetings this year, you'll likely see David on podium presenting data from one of the over 70 clinical trials he's been principal investigator on. And I think more important than any of all this is that David is just a really good guy. He takes care of all those around him, from his patients to his staff to those he mentors on a daily basis. In our conversation, we touch on a number of topics. We start off with the hot topic of geographic atrophy and our early experiences treating this unmet need in our clinic so far. We talk about the ever-changing landscape of retina and how the field continues to evolve. In that context, we talk about our own ever-changing roles as investigators, as mentors, and as stewards for the next generation of retina specialists that are starting to come into the fold. David peppers the conversation with great anecdotes and inspirational quotes, as he normally does, and I think you'll enjoy his always thoughtful banter. I'm thrilled to be able to give our listeners some new insights from someone I consider a friend and someone that will continue to make a meaningful impact in our field for many years to come. So, without further delay, please enjoy my conversation with Dr. David Eichenbaum. So, David, thank you for joining us here on New Insights. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Great to have you on today.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm excited for this series. You're one of my most favorite, most sociable retina people. We hang out, and I hope this series has a lot of hanging out.
Yeah, so hopefully, you know, the reason I'm having you on is you and I have had lots of conversations, on the side or at meetings or whatever, and hopefully we can give some folks some insights into you know, the insights, the nonsense, all the stuff that we chat about from day to day, but in a way where, you know, we can kind of give them a little view behind the curtain here. Okay, so we're gonna jump right in. Super grateful to have you on. Someone that's got a ton of experience, really knows the landscape better than anybody, and has done so much. And we'll kind of touch on all the different things and hopefully give people some understanding of who you are and what you've been doing in this space and some of the innovative stuff you've been doing recently. So, you know, first I have to talk about GA, right? Because since you and I last talked, we've had the Apellis approval of Syfovre. We're on the verge of a potential second product from Iveric. And so you've now had a few months to roll out this kind of new drug, new treatment, hit this unmet need that you and I have been talking about for years. What's your experience been thus far, and what are some things that have worked well? What are some of the challenges that you may not have expected as we rolled this out?
No, it's a hot topic for sure. Before we dive into that, I want to reflect on one thing you said for our audience, especially maybe our younger audience who are in fellowship or coming out of fellowship. I bet that's a large part of the consumption of your program. It's your youthful vigor that brings the young folks forward. You know, the stuff that you said, it slipped right by, but you said the stuff that we talk about on the side at the meetings, that's the most important stuff in our field. That's why people have to go to meetings. You got to be present. You know, you can watch a million podcasts, read a million CMEs, redo your residency and fellowship, but you will not stay current if you don't have those sidebars in person at meetings. So I'm glad we're back to pre-pandemic style meetings, and I look forward to lots more of those sidebars.
Yeah, agree. I mean, you and I talked about it. Like, COVID was great. We got to do all the meetings because we did them all from home. But the one thing I think we really didn't realize we were missing out on until we got back to the meetings in person was all the sidebars. Yeah. Because I think so much gets talked about. That's just as important as the stuff that gets out there, you know, at the meeting itself. So yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, all guess. And so GA, let's go back to, we'll get back on topic. So GA, biggest surprise, you know, as you and I have been involved in GA research, I've been doing clinical science along with you for about 15 years. We both have homegrown clinical research programs. There are a handful of folks around the country who've done what we do, and we all know each other and stick together. We've been disappointed by GA drugs for over a decade, right? And now it's an amazing thing that we have two drugs that show some clinical efficacy. You could argue all night about how important that is. Are they good enough? Are they bad enough? Where are they in the grand scheme of things? That's a different conversation. But we have two drugs that are showing clinical efficacy and a pre-specified primary endpoint that's approvable by the FDA for at least one, probably two drugs. So we have Syfovre out there in the market. And the biggest surprise for me is the appetite that patients have for this drug. And as a clinical scientist and a GA researcher, along with you and a bunch of our buddies, I've undersold GA treatment's potential for years. And when I was talking to patients about this drug, a lot of my first patients were patients who were excluded from clinical trials for a variety of reasons. My very first patient had, I think, screen failed for like four trials in the last 6 or 8 years. And I told him, we got something now, and here's what it does. Here are the limitations. Here's the benefits. Here's the risk. He's like, give it to me, doc, in both my eyes. I'm like, really? He's like, yes. And I've had that reaction over and over and over again. And so far, in the first handful of months of treatment, I started injecting Syfovre March 1st. I'll probably start Ivorix drug the same day it's available. I have a ton of experience as a clinical trialist in the Gather 1 and 2 programs. In the last 3 months, patients have had high fidelity. They've had enthusiasm. It's not enough time to test the waters. I think we're still learning a lot about how to use these drugs, but I'm surprised at the appetite that patients have for these drugs. Surprised on the opposite side. What's the negative surprise? I'm negatively surprised at the kind of trepidation that retina docs have, not about the data, but about how am I going to do this? You know, they have a treatment that's approvable. They have a treatment with some clinical efficacy. And when I'm talking about the drug, either at a meeting or to a friend, or I'm doing commercial speaking for both Apellis and for Ivorix Bio, people ask, how do I do this? How do I work this in? How are we going to get this done? There's this fear of treating this new disease. Not so much a fear of adverse events or of the data, but of actually getting it done, which surprised me because we're enthusiastic. We're retina docs. We get things done. We're adaptable. We're smart. And I talk about my strategies for that. And I think that unpacking those nuts and bolts is going to be a big part of treating GA.
So I think, you know, you're touching on a point where I think, you know, we may be a little bit skewed because we've been thinking about these conversations for many years. We've been having these conversations for many years. And so I think you're right. And I'm trying to think back to when we were doing some of the older, like the LAMPA studies and things, yeah, and how I was kind of framing it and where I was in the thought process. I think, you know, I do think that part of it is there's a learning curve to this conversation as well. You know, we're coming from treating neovascular AMD and DME and being able to show patients almost immediate results with these treatments, whereas we're not able to do that now. So it's almost like, and I think you and I have talked about, it's almost like treating glaucoma. And as retina specialists, we're not used to treating glaucoma, right? And so,
yeah,
or creating glaucoma, sure, but not treating it, right? So I think that, you know, that's an issue that we're coping with now. I think that the other issue I think you hit on the head, which is I was recently talking to a group about you know, starting treatment for GA patients, and they were worried that these floodgates were going to open,
mm-hmm,
and they weren't sure they were going to be able to manage it just from an operational standpoint. So I think there's definitely, you've kind of identified a couple of pain points, a couple of hurdles for groups and for individual docs, and I think we're going to slowly start to see those hurdles come down, especially as, you know, you're talking about the feedback from the patients, right? This appetite, this kind of desire to do something meaningful and change the course of their disease. And I think you're right, as more of us use this and more of us can consistently say, look, these are safe, and that a year from now, 2 years from now, I can look back with that patient and say, look, I made a meaningful kind of course correction in your disease, right? I think maybe, yeah, that's the best way I can describe it. I think you're right. I think what you're experiencing is what a lot of us are experiencing as we kind of start off on this kind of new frontier for patients. And it's exciting. Yeah, I think as many kind of questions we're answering, we're coming up with new questions. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be interesting 6 months from now, a year from now, when the landscape's a little more mature, we've got two products, we're figuring out kind of which tool we're using for each patient to kind of circle back to this conversation and revisit it and see if things have changed, right?
And, you know, and I think of an analogy to this, to the hurdles that you're talking about. You know, we do have a lot to learn. We have a lot to learn about the real world treatment of GA. The real world data is going to be much more impactful than the registration data, especially for the Ivoric product, which has a relatively small N in registration, assuming we get approval for that, as we hope, in August. But, you know, if you turn the clock back and if we could talk to a retina specialist in the year 2005 instead of 2023 and tell him or her, you're going to be doing 40 or 50 or 60 injections a day for wet AMD, they would be like, what? How am I going to do that? That's never going to happen. You know, I got all these lasers to do. I got all these PDTs to do. I have vitrectomies for diabetic retinopathy. How am I going to work in these injections? And it's amazing. You know, we can't imagine the retinal field without the 40 or 50 or 60 injections a day. And now we might have to because of other innovations. That's, you know, gene therapy, durable therapy, multimodal therapy, things, alternative targets, what have you. But things change in the field, and treating GA is a change, and we will embrace it. I tell the docs when they have this trepidation that, you know, we can do this. You know, we flexed the whole field into something different. We shaped it into something different just 15 years ago. We're not even shaping this into something different. We're just doing basically more of what we do, but to a different end. So I think that this trepidation will be fleeting, and I'm optimistic we'll be able to wrap our heads around it, as well as everything else that comes down the pipeline, the things that work and the things that are good for patients.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, you talk about 2005, that's when you and I were kind of just starting out in our careers, and, you know, we got to see kind of the advent and the you know, just the rollout of anti-VEGFs. And I remember the first time we were doing them in like ORs and then gowned up and everything. And now it's like you said, we'll do 50 or 60.
Yeah.
And it you don't even think twice about it. And so, yeah, I think you're right. I think there's going to be a balance. You know, I think, you know, as these injections come online and we've got to fit them in our schedule, you're right. I think we're also seeing the transition with these longer acting agents, right? We had Vabysmo come out last year. We've got potentially high dose Eylea coming out, you know, later this year. And maybe that helps us kind of create capacity and ease the burden on just clinic flows, right? Okay, now we're doing half as many of these wet AMD injections. Maybe that's how we create space. So I think you're right. I think we're really good at figuring it out, right? Well, we'll get creative if we have to. But I think just naturally things this might be the perfect time for it, given what's happening on the other side of things, right? So that's a good kind of segue to something I was going to ask you about. You wrote a consensus piece recently about, you know, a very durable drug, Iluvien. I just want to, I was touching on that. I looked over that recently, and I want you to kind of talk about what you found. And I think, you know, it's interesting because we've had this drug for so long and we've been looking for durability, and you guys had a really nice paper about it. So I'd love to bring that insight in for the audience here.
Yeah, so that was a cool piece. That was led by our friend Sinuhar Prasad, was one of the key motivators for that piece. So shout out to Sinu, big brother Sinu. You know, what's really interesting about Iluvien and super durable therapies, Iluvien, Yutiq, which of course is closely related to Iluvien, even more closely related commercially as of last week.
Yeah.
Durable drugs are poorly understood by clinicians. I think they kind of want them, but they're kind of afraid of them because even though they semi-complain about all these shots, they kind of like the controllability of the shots. They like the flow. They're comfortable doing a lot of shots. So they want fewer shots, but not too fewer shots. So we can't quite wrap our heads around this very durable drug that we significantly reduce our shots. And the other piece of that is there's only a niche group of patients who really need long-standing corticosteroid suppression in diabetic. So it's always the kind of drug. We will see ground when we were put out in the video, which I really liked, the was basically trying to look for patterns as to where people think it fits. And we reported the patterns of where people think it fits. And what's interesting is there were not a lot of consistent patterns, because I think people have a tough time wrapping their head around the drug, wrapping their head around its utilization, and kind of finding the right patients for Iluvien. I do think that it has a role. You know, I've been the advocate of corticosteroids for a long time. Part of that's my training. I did my fellowship at Tufts Ophthalmic Consultants of Boston, where the very first intravitreal triamcinolone data came from Adam Martinez way back before I even was a fellow there. So there was a lot of exposure to corticosteroids in my training. And I think that the specificity of our very advanced targeted biologics, which have been anti-angiogenic and now anti-angiogenic and anti-ang2, do miss the pathologic cytokines in a proportion of these diabetic patients. So I'm working to figure out, and that paper is part of how we're figuring out how to disseminate the message of where ILUVIEN and long-term corticosteroid suppression fits. Something analogous to that, which retina specialists have had a tough time with, and there have been some safety issues with it too, that are being mitigated, is the port delivery system for wet macular degeneration. You and I work closely with that product too. There's, you know, my very good friend, Lloyd Clark, and I had a conversation before Vabysmo and before PDS or Susvimo launched. And he said to me, David, Vabysmo's got all the tailwinds and Susvimo's got all the headwinds. Susvimo's got to get through those headwinds to be successful. And I think the issue we've had with the septum gives it even more headwinds. But one of the headwinds he and I talked about was the true durability in that little implant, and having retina specialists figure out where that fits, the patient type, the clinic flow, the revenue cycle, all of that stuff. And that was a pretty profound statement. And ILUVIEN's like that. ILUVIEN's always had a lot of headwinds.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think you're right. I think I picked it up because it was an interesting moment right now, I think, with a lot more discussion about new MOAs and targeting something beyond just anti-VEGF, for example, and looking at durability and creating more space in the clinic and all those things. So I thought it was the perfect time to kind of, you know, rehash some of that information and then kind of bring that out and talk about, you know, what physicians are thinking about when it comes to that. So I like that. The other thing you mentioned there was, you know, Sido Hariprasad, he's a mentor of mine. And so one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, now we're at the point in our careers where, you know, we have fellows and we're at these meetings and we're talking about things on the podium. And so my question to you is, you know, have you thought about now kind of how your career is shifting, and one, how fortunate we have been to have really, really great mentors, and now what our role is moving forward, and how we're kind of embracing some of that mentorship. But, you know, are you thinking about that? Are you doing that? Is that something you're looking forward to as you move on?
Absolutely. It's a great question. I'm glad you brought that up. It's something we talked about at VBS this year also. It's so funny. VBS was a meeting that I remember going to the very first kind of full format VBS meeting in the Fontainebleau more than, I guess, about a decade ago, maybe a little more than that. And now fast forward, I'm now on the moderator side of VBS, which is kind of where you get to be a mentor in your 40s, which is a little like a senior at VBS in your 40s. So we were talking about mentorship some at that meeting. And you got to be ready. You got to be ready to be the last author on the paper. And I feel very happy to be able to offer that to medical students and residents. You know, I'm here to guide you. I'm here to provide the idea, provide the data, provide editorial support. You put in the work, you put in the basic science and clinical science research, you find the citations, you write it up, I will mentor you through this paper. And I've been doing more and more of that with both the residents that we trained at the Morsani College of Medicine and when they move along. So there's this dynamic duo of a medical student and a postgraduate named Farhan and Abe, who are like ready to be mentored. They're ready to work with me. They're almost like sponges. They're like, give me a case, give me a topic, give me a disease state to write about. And you'll see on LinkedIn and where I've been pushing out their work, these guys are ready to go. And guys and gals like that all over the country are ready to go. They just need to find someone like you, or like the role I want to serve for my medical student and resident population, and be their mentor. But you and I have taken the leap, and I encourage others at our age and stage to take the leap. You don't need that first authorship anymore. You're ready to be the last author on the paper. And when you're comfortable with your career, I think the best thing you can do to give back to the next generation is provide that service and provide that resource to younger docs and younger students.
No, I agree with that 100%. And you're doing a fantastic job with that. I think you're right. I think that we're at that stage where you see it. You see a lot of the people that, you know, we were those two guys, you know, not that long ago, right? And I think it's fun to see kind of that next wave come through, because you know that at the end of the day, this all of this only moves forward if we've got that pipeline of people kind of working on it, right? Because there's going to be a day where eventually we slow down or hang it up entirely, right? So let's talk about that for a second. So, you know, we've also talked about family. And I think, you know, with COVID, we all had a second to pause and kind of recalibrate, spent a lot more time at home. That in very kind of other ways where we said, look, this is a great time to kind of, if just important, work is important, all that stuff's important, but our kids are getting older. You know, how do we balance some of those things? And I think you've done a really good job of that. And so that's one of the things I wanted to also bring on this conversation, because I think a lot of that part out, right? I think it's hard to say no to certain things, to meetings or to you know, to get-togethers or to whatever it is from a work standpoint. So how are you being a little pickier and choosier and selecting some of these things these days?
Yeah. So how do you be there for your career and be there for your kids and your spouse and your friends and be there for yourself? And it's like what Jack Welch said, the old legendary CEO of GE. He said that there is no work-life balance. He's right. Work-life balance is a myth that doesn't exist. There are work-life choices. You are always making choices. And if you don't think about this and have a strategy, the choices will kind of fall as they may, and that things may not look like the way you want them to look. Before the pandemic, when I was a brand new retina specialist, I got into industry with commercial speaking. I was the guy who would go anywhere, and that was cool. I got to go to Dothan, Alabama, Des Moines, Iowa, Poughkeepsie, you know, all these places I never have visited. And that was cool because it was kind of like being on tour. It was like opening for AC/DC, which I've always wanted to do and I'm never going to get to do. But, you know, that was not sustainable. I had a young daughter at the time. And looking back at that time, I wasn't around. I was making choices that were just not going to be sustainable. I don't think that if I was doing that today, that my marriage would be as good as it is, and my family wouldn't be as kind of put together as it is, and my career would look different, not better necessarily, but it would look different. So you know, you got to think about and be proactive about what you want to do. I still love to travel and do advisory boards meetings, commercial speaking, see how retina is practiced in the trenches, if you will, in the communities all around the country and all around the world now. You and I have been doing this all over the world for the last couple of years, pre-pandemic and now post-pandemic. But you got to be deliberate about it. You have to kind of make a pie chart of where you want to spend your time. You can write it down. I think about it a lot, but I don't write it down. And you decide, you know, I'm cutting out this time for work. I'm choosing this time for my family. And I'm choosing this time for self. And then two pieces of advice that I would give younger folks with young families is, number one, round the corners by spending money. A lot of the inconveniences of life and things that bug you can be made less painful by just spending money on them. You know, you need help at home, hire a nanny. You need more help, hire another nanny. You're able to do this as a retina specialist, number one. Number two, when you are spending your excess income, never tell your family you can't afford it if you're spending it on non-familial activities like hobbies or friends. Make your family the priority luxury spend, and round the corners from another bucket of money. That's financial advice and sort of family advice all rolled in one. And I think if you do those two things, that helps justify some extra work to have the opportunity to do that. I rarely tell my family we can't do something because we can't afford it. Whereas I tell myself I can't do things all the time because it's not in the budget. But I try to prioritize the luxury spend on the family. And that really has worked out well. And that only works if you also can carve out the time in your pie chart to spend with your family. You've got to make a choice to not do that meeting make a choice to not do that talk in Dothan, Alabama, or Des Moines, Iowa, or wherever you have to go overnight. You know, do the talk virtually. Do a talk that you can do a round trip to. Go to a regional advisory board instead of a national advisory board. You know, and plan a year in advance. Share your calendar with your spouse. Don't pop things on there a week before if something else is coming up. Be deliberate. Make choices, like Jack Welch said. Don't balance, choose.
Yeah, no, I think it's great advice. You know, we have a fellow that's graduating in a few weeks here. And, you know, the reason it kind of came up recently was, you know, we're just talking about it. You know, they're expecting their first child. He's taking a job down in Florida. And it's like, you know,
smart
big
man.
Things. Yeah, exactly. Your neck of the woods. So, but he's making, you know, all these big decisions. They can be stressful, but it is, you know, one of those things where we can hopefully offer perspective and say, look, there's going to be times where you get lost in the work and you're busy and, you know, days will fly by, weeks will fly by, but, you know, try to stay grounded and keep those priorities for sure. It's hard in the beginning, right? Because you're really trying to establish yourself. But I think we're fortunate enough now, and our kids are still young enough now where we can kind of, you know, continue to make those things a priority. So, you know, talking about that, right? You've done some stuff that's a little bit different, and I want to talk about that as well. So Network I, right? You've been working on that. Just a fascinating kind of project that has turned into something just huge. And so I want, again, people that are listening that may not know what that is, for you to give a little bit of insight. One, why did you do it? What was the genesis of this idea? Because you, as a retina specialist that's already busy doing all the things you just talked about, including clinical trial work and traveling, and how did you come up with this concept, and where did it come from?
Yes, that's a great question. I love talking about Network. My wife says I have 4 full-time jobs. She's probably right, but this is one of the full-time jobs. So Network I came really from these sidebars at meetings. One of the meetings that I've attended for years that I've gone to with a person who trained with me named Lindsay Smith, and who's a medical retina specialist in DC, is the Aspen Retinal Detachment Society meeting. And me and her husband, who's a serial entrepreneur, have talked about different ways to be entrepreneurial in healthcare for a very long time, for over the decade that we've been attending that meeting. 14 years we've gone to that meeting, missing it once when we had our daughter. We've talked about the marriage of entrepreneurship, behavior change, and retail, which he and one of our other co-founders have some expertise in, and really providing these great treatments we have to more people. Why are half the diabetics not getting treatment? You know, and there's a lot of reasons for that. And why, especially, are the social determinants of health falling in such a way that Black and Brown patients don't get the same access to treatment that Caucasian patients do, which is a terrible disservice that we have in the American healthcare system. So the way that we decided we would try to fix some of this is by marrying retail with medical retina care. And what we've started doing, we've been operational just over a year, is we got investors together and found a partner in CVS, and we are running a 550 square foot medical retina clinic inside a CVS store in Tampa. What's remarkable about that is 2 things. Number one is the source of our patients. We do have traditional referrals from local optometrists and ophthalmologists, and that's not remarkable. What's remarkable is that we're also using AI technology. We're currently using the digital diagnostics imaging platform to go into the community, to churches, to fire stations, to schools, to old folks' homes, where patients with diabetes exist, but they don't necessarily have routine eye exams, and we're imaging them. And when they have diabetes, we're not just saying, oh, you have diabetes based on this AI image, you got to go find an eye doctor. We say, you have diabetes, come see us at CVS. And one of the reasons that people, especially people of color, do not seek healthcare is there's problems with trust in the healthcare system, in addition to problems with access. And Network I takes a very broad spectrum of insurance coverage, a broad spectrum of payers, and it's located in a friendly, warm, low stress, low hassle retail environment where a caregiver and a patient can easily go and get things done, pick up prescriptions, go shopping inside the CVS, and get medical retina care. And it's doing very well. We're seeing a lot of patients And the demographics prove that our thesis is correct. And one of our offices is about 2.5-3 miles from the CVS. And that office in Tampa sees 90 to 95% Caucasian patients. The CVS store and the Network Eye Clinic inside it treat and see less than 40% Caucasian patients, just 3 miles, 2-3 miles from one of our offices. So it's more than just, you know, it's more than just the location, more than just the insurances. It's also putting the friendly, easy access retail environment and the great care that we can provide in retina together. And if this continues to do well, we're looking at deepening our partnership with CVS and speaking with other retailers, of course, as well, and seeing if we can scale this and move this model into other places, other markets outside of Tampa and outside of Florida, where there is this disparity in healthcare. And you know, the good businesses, like the pharmaceutical business, if you do good, you do well. You know, if you have a good drug, you know, great drugs, and Eylea and Vabysmo, and going back to Lucentis, Ozurdex, these drugs do well because they do good for people. You know, Eylea is one of the biggest drugs that's ever been developed because it's a good drug. We're hoping that Network Eye, because it does good for people, will be a good business and do well. And we are hopefully coming to a town near you.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. I mean, I think we've kind of seen it. I've kind of followed along with what you guys are doing, and I think you're exactly right. We've had an access issue in this country for forever, right? And I think figuring out ways to do that and leveraging technologies and understanding kind of the spaces we have to be in physically to get people these care is really critical. So I applaud you guys, and I'm looking forward to watching you guys scale this out, come into Chicago, because I think Chicago is very similar, right? I mean, I think we, even in our own offices, we can just see these pockets of people that do get care, and we know, you know, there's plenty of pockets that don't get care. So being able to you know, reach those areas and treat those people that need it just as much as anybody else is going to be an important thing that we need to do moving forward. So great work. And I'm glad you get to kind of explain that to people, because I think it's an important thing for people to know. So as we kind of round the final lap here, I want to ask you, now we've got all these meetings ahead of us, ASRS and everything down the road here. What are you looking forward to? You know, you had mentioned kind of AI and you guys leveraging that technology with Network Eye. You know, what are the things that you're looking forward to, whether it's this kind of meeting season coming up or maybe just in the years ahead, as we've kind of now looked at addressing one unmet need with GA, where are we going next?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And, you know, I think a lot of people look at the pipeline, they're like, look at all this great stuff. And I guess the double-edged sword of age that you and I both share in almost lockstep is that not everything works, you know? So we kind of got to look at what we know about the emerging technologies and bet on what we're enthusiastic about. You know, I am enthusiastic about kind of moonshots, like potential for cell therapy, optogenetics, that's cool. But we have no idea if that's going to work well. It's very early. In much later phase development, I'm enthusiastic about alternative targets. I think that we're drilling down in the tyrosine kinase inhibitors is something that may actually reduce treatment burden. I've been doing a lot of gene therapy. You've been doing a lot of gene therapy. There's a lot of promise there, but there are a lot of unknowns. We're going to have to unpack that in a much bigger way than we unpack something like another injection. So I'm looking forward to unpacking that. But I'm looking forward to, in the next several years, aside from the drugs and the science and the research and all that stuff, is seeing young retina specialists kind of blossom. I've been fortunate that my practice has grown by 3 retina specialists after me, all of which are younger, smarter, and better trained than I am. And I'm excited to see their careers grow. I'm excited. I have a very enthusiastic new associate who's not new to retina, but new to our practice by a year and a half, Priya Vakaria. She's an incredible clinical science mind, very good on the podium. And there's a whole crop of people who are similar to her, 10 to 15 years younger than we are. And I want to see those people excel. Because like you said earlier, you say profound things in short sentences. The future of the specialty are the young retina specialists. I'm looking forward to seeing what the people that we mentor do in the next 10 years? And I think you and I are not going to slow down in the next decade, hopefully not in the next two decades, but eventually time retires everybody. And I feel like I'm at the point in my career where I know that it's not going to go on forever. And I'm excited that the next generation of docs is better than we are and is going to move the field forward further than we have. And I want to see that happen, even if it's from a nursing home someday. I'm excited.
Yeah, well, we're hopefully far away from that. But
yeah.
But I think that's the best answer I've heard yet, right? I think the AI, gene therapy, all that stuff's important. But your answer of, hey, it's the people, right, that we're actually most excited about, I think you're spot on. I don't think I've thought about it in that sense. But I think you're right. That's probably now number one on my list of things that I'm most excited about. So, no, I love it. David, thank you again for the time. I know you're a busy guy. You've got four full-time jobs and obviously time to sit down and talk about this, I think, says a lot about you and a lot of the things that you've already talked about, which is really giving back and helping spread that knowledge to the folks that really want to soak it up and move things forward for us. So thank you again for the time. I'm sure I'll be seeing you in person soon at one of the meetings coming up and just really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. We need to do this with some whiskey sometime in the next.
We will in person soon.
All right. Take care, Viral.
All right, David. Thank you.
Thank you for listening in to the New Insight Podcast. We really appreciate your time. Be sure to subscribe to our channel on your preferred listening or watching platform. And if you're interested in more ophthalmology news or other podcasts, visit hcplive.com and check out our offerings. For now, I'm Dr. Viral Sheth. Hope to see you next time to discuss what's new in sight.